Welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, March 14th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. So first and foremost, I have to say, Happy Pi Day, everyone. March 14th, 314. Of course, here in America, that is how we write our day and dates. We are a little bit backward from the rest of the world, but because of that, we have a chance to eat pie, to celebrate our favorite number, and of course, to say happy birthday to Albert Einstein, who just so happened to be born on Pi Day. I also want to let you guys know that I'm recording this intro from my hotel room in New York City. I am here working on Fab Lab, the children's show that I do some work for that premieres, doesn't premiere, it just airs. That makes more sense. That airs Saturday mornings on Fox. So yeah, that's where I am, and that's why it might be a little noisier, and the microphone might not sound quite as good. But I do want to start the show by thanking everybody who has supported Talk Nerdy in the week preceding. First and foremost, I want to give a shout out to everybody who is signed up to be a patron of the show at www.patreon.com/talknerdy. I want to thank Phil T-Bear and Timothy Glover because of your amazing patronage in the highest bracket. I also want to thank the Honorable Husband, Malcolm Wadi II, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeff Sewell. And I want to thank those of you who have visited my website, carasantamaria.com, and clicked on the little PayPal portal to support the show that way. I want to thank Marcella Liddick and Amanda Munster, and big, huge, huge thank you to Paul Springfield from, it looks like, Staines, Middlesex in the United Kingdom. Just huge support this week. It really helps so, so much. And thank you from all of the listeners right now who rely on support like you to help keep Talk Nerdy 100% free to download. All right, guys, let's jump into the show. I'm so excited about this week's episode where I had a chance to spend some time with Sandon Totten. He is the science reporter for KPCC, the Los Angeles local NPR affiliate, and he is also one of the hosts of a wonderful podcast for kids called Brains On. Here he is, Sandon Totten.
Sandon, thank you so much for joining me.
I am so excited to be here.
Me too. We've been talking about podcasting for like months.
Yeah, we actually taught a class about podcasting.
Oh, yeah.
We've told other people about podcasting, yet we can't seem to get our act together until now.
I know. Why is that? And don't we not live that far away from one
another? No, it was like three miles, 3.1 or something.
So we are shooting the shit on a Saturday. It is a beautiful day in LA.
Yep.
Oh my gosh, you commented on that when you walked in the door. It's a little cold.
Right.
By LA standards.
By that, I mean, I got to wear a jean jacket today.
But it's so clear because it's been raining recently and
yep.
You can see really far into the hills and enjoy nature the way LA nature intends us to enjoy it.
First thing I did today was take a hike and went up to Griffith Observatory and just looked out at my splendor. And my dad, Mustafa, was like, son, one day all of this will be yours.
So do you hike a lot?
Yeah, that's like one of my favorite things to do. I love Griffith Park.
I'm moving basically to Griffith Park. I'm actually in the process of doing it right now. I never hike. I'm so not outdoorsy. I'm hoping that this move will change me because I can walk from my front door to a hiking trail.
Yeah, it's your backyard now.
Yeah, and I'll just be a jerk if I don't spend more time out there.
When I first moved to LA, I was coming from Minnesota and I had a lot of trouble because LA is so vast and it's full of concrete and it's a mega city, right? And I was feeling that in my bones. But then I discovered Griffith Park, and it's like the playground for adults. Like, you can go there, you can listen to a podcast or some music, you can get in your own little bubble and run around. If you feel like picking at a tree that's peeling, you can do that. If you feel like throwing a rock down a ravine, you can do that. If like a little squirrel comes up to you, you can just sit there and watch it. It's like all these like instincts that sort of die as you become an adult come back alive in Griffith Park. That's why I really love it.
That's so true. You can like dig around in the dirt for bugs, but you can also do things that are a little more social there. Like you can be alone or you can go to the observatory or ride the merry-go-round or even go to the zoo.
Yeah, actually, a friend of mine taught a class about foraging there too. So I've been learning a little bit about which plants you can pick and make tea out of.
Oh.
and which cool. ones you can, you know, mix into salads and stuff.
And which ones you can pick and then die from.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really fuzzy on which are which, though. So it's like I've taken the class and I have it all on my phone, but I'm so paranoid that I really don't eat any or pick anything. I just sort of point it out to other people.
Yeah. You don't want to have an into the wild experience in Griffith Park. That would be very
sad. Yeah. I'm not
sad.
That outdoorsy. Yeah. That's like if I'm going to pick an forage, I still will do it like at a salad bar. At,
yeah,
like, Whole
for
Foods.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, ooh, I think I've spotted some wild arugula.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fun up there. And, you know, we were just talking, I've been talking to a lot of people around KCET because we did a story on P22 and P32, kind of his sad counterpart, about just being a lonely puma, a lonely mountain lion living in Griffith Park, 8 square miles when you need like 200. Mm-hmm. And somehow he's been making it for six years. And then there was just big news. I don't know if it was international. Would you say it was international news or was like really big LA news?
I don't know. It blew up my feed. Yeah. And I had people from Portland texting me about it.
Okay. So they were reading. So it wasn't just like the LA Times. It wasn't just KCET, KPCC, where you work, or kind of local feeds, but probably some international feeds picked it up. But yeah, it's thought. We can't be 100% sure.
I am so glad you're using jurisprudence here because so yeah. many people have been quick to judge, but go ahead.
Yes, there is circumstantial evidence to support that P22, our local mountain lion who we love, may have jumped into the koala enclosure at the LA Zoo and snacked on a koala that tends to hang out on the ground.
Yep. So let's piece together some of the things we know here, serial style, okay? What we know is that there is a zoo in Griffith Park, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the same, you know, habitat that P22 hangs out in. So they're bound to interact. Then we find out that also P22 had showed up on their cameras on and off. So they somehow he was getting into their zoo enclosure, which, you know, they don't just leave open willy-nilly. It is sort of secure. But somehow he was finding a way in. They did not know how. Also, apparently, and this kind of shocked me, the koalas, did you hear this too? They seem to be able to get out of their pen sometimes and just wander around.
Yeah, and I think that I read that the zoo officials weren't in the best habit of bringing them in at night. And the truth is, for the most part, who gives a shit? Like, they're fine because the koala enclosure is, you've probably seen this at your local zoo, it's like a big ditch. Like
right.
you, there's like a concrete barrier and you can look down into the koalas and they've got their little trees they climb, but they're fucking koalas. Like they just hang out down there.
Right.
And most koalas sleep in trees. But there's one very sweet koala that didn't like to sleep in the trees.
Did you read? They had like a profile of his personality and stuff somewhere I was reading.
Yeah, what was her name? It started with a K. It was like Kalua or something like that. Yeah, it was definitely a her. I'm going to look up the P22 koala as we continue.
So yeah, I will go on some more. So some of the other evidence is that they first sort of noticed one was missing during the daily head count. And there was some tufts of fur somewhere. And they started to get suspicious. And then eventually they found the mangled corpse, from what I understand.
Yep. Oh, and she was 14. Her name was Killarney. Killarney.
Aww.
Oh, that's fitting. Killarney. I might be pronouncing that wrong, but yeah, 14, mauled to death. And then they were like, who done it?
Who done it? So they had looked on their video cameras and they saw that P22 had been around recently. So one of the things I'm wondering about this case is can't you, you know, I watch these TV shows in CSI, they figure out everything from the body. They have this koala body. Can't they figure out, like, based on the claw sizes and the teeth marks, what animal it was? Because some people think maybe it was a bobcat, maybe it was coyotes.
Yeah, maybe they're in the process of doing the necropsy right now. Maybe. I mean, I'm sure somebody is looking into that. It's the media is very excited about the fact that it's like a big whodunit. CBS News, I just saw, has an article called LA Confidential. Who killed the koala?
I want a CSI zoo edition or something.
That would be awesome.
Special zoo unit.
And the truth of the matter is, you know, I texted Jason Goldman, who's a mutual friend of ours, the minute I saw the first inkling in my feed. And I was on a shoot, so I couldn't spend time reading it. And I saw like P22 eats koala or something. And I was like, what the fuck? So I texted Jason, did P22 really eat a koala in the zoo? And he was like, evidence is circumstantial, but it looks likely. And I was like, what the fuck? Did the koala escape or did he break in? And he was like, apparently he jumped into the enclosure. And I was like, no way. But then here comes the rub. People are getting nervous. And Jason actually published an article at KCET's website. This is not a case for relocating this mountain lion.
Oh, no.
And we're so afraid that people are, oh, it killed a koala. It's out for blood, you know? And it's like, no, this is a natural habitat for this organism who is an apex predator. If there is food to be had, he will have it. Mm-hmm. And luckily, Zoo officials did release a public statement that said that, you know, they understand that he is living, that they are in this habitat and they're going to have to adapt accordingly.
Yeah, I like the way they said that. You know, he's adapted to all the things we've thrown in his way. So many obstacles, you know, like freeways, rodenticide, you know, the collar we make him wear. Yeah. And he's still hanging on, you know, and we should cut him some slack here. He's just being an animal and doing his thing. Not only that, but if he could get in, I'm surprised coyotes haven't gotten in, or bobcats, because those are also, you know, nefarious hunters and probably have a taste for exotic food too.
Yeah, that's true. And they might have an even easier time. Like a bobcat may, I don't know much about the difference in jumping or climbing ability between
certainly smaller,
a puma
so they can
and a bobcat.
Creep
yeah.
through stuff better.
Totally. Like a puma's a big animal.
Yeah.
So I know he can jump really high. Like he's got that. He can scale fences pretty readily. But otherwise, he's a cat. And you know how cats can like make themselves weirdly smaller than they are?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That weird skill to like almost become invisible and then just show up on the other side of a fence. But yeah, bobcats are much, much smaller. And coyotes, of course, will eat anything.
Right. And they're pretty clever. I mean, I'm pretty sure they'd figure out how to stack up on top of each other and get over a fence if they had to.
Coyote Tetris.
Right. But the thing is, if they break in, they're probably going straight for trash or like the candied apples. I mean, they'll eat anything.
They so will.
They're
yeah.
the Templeton rats of food. I mean, of animals.
My worry was that, okay, so P22, let's say he did break in. He found a koala. He had a snack, which, again, don't blame him. Easy meal.
Right. I mean, he's never tried Outback Steakhouse.
Exactly.
He doesn't know what he's missing.
He
you know?
Doesn't know.
And there's something cool, I think, about the fact that a mountain lion born in the Santa Monica Mountains here in Los Angeles got to eat an animal that came from another part of the world. Like, that just doesn't happen very often, that two wild animals from different parts of the world would have this interaction. I mean, obviously one ended up a lot better for it than the other, but it's still really interesting.
It's true. He's kind of like a posh world traveler. Yeah. He's like, I will try kangaroo for the first time. Yeah, that's hilarious. But my worry is this the first time he's ever eaten anything in the zoo? And if so, is he going to be like, oh, this is a place I can go for food?
That's a good idea. That's a good point, you know? And I mean, I'm glad he got a meal. I feel bad for this koala, but obviously you wouldn't want him to think of this as his local refrigerator, you
exactly.
know? That he could just go there whenever he was really having trouble hunting and sort of find stuff, because there's lots of other things he could be, even if he's not necessarily killing, terrorizing and stressing out a lot of these animals by lurking around at night. And causing a lot of mayhem, you know?
And what if he found his way into an enclosure that he should not be in, like a gorilla enclosure Ooh. Or a lion enclosure, where actually it could end up worse for him? You know, he could be in the koala shoes. Like, that could be very dangerous. So
right.
hopefully, now that we know that there is a capability, they're looking for breaches in security. They're looking for ways to kind of protect the animals a little better. And, you know, now I think the National Park Service and the Santa Monica Mountains biologists have more data as they're looking at this Griffith Park connectivity study, because it is really interesting to see what nature we have, as you said, in our backyard and that we can see while hiking, although P22 is very elusive. You'll never
Can we get
see
a moment
it.
Of silence for Killarney? Killarney, was it?
Killarney? I don't know how to pronounce it yet, but moment of silence.
All right, koala friend. You're in the giant eucalyptus tree in the sky now.
I know. It's very sweet. 14 years sounds like a long life. I've no idea how long koalas live. I'm going to look that up while we're talking too. But 14 years seems like a good run.
I mean, they're like the size of dogs, right?
Exactly.
That seems like, you know,
koala life span. Is that what I look up? Oh, life expectancy.
Turns out they live like hundreds of years.
13 to 18 in the wild, which probably means in captivity it's a lot longer. Usually
yeah.
it's way longer in captivity. Oh, well, she died in her prime. She died looking good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I don't think it'll be an open casket for
no,
her.
No, probably.
Not after P22.
Oof, it's rough. Rough time for Killarney. We'll miss you, girl. All right, so Sandin, we didn't even jump into this yet, but for people who may not know, especially for people who aren't LA local, even though we do have a really big LA listenership, tell everybody listening a little bit about what you do, because you have the real skills in the radio and the podcasting world.
Yeah, so I am a public radio nerd. I work for NPR's local affiliate, KPCC, Southern California Public Radio, where I am a science reporter, which is this like really rare bird of a job, you know? I mean, you and I both work in this field, but you probably know as well as I do, the jobs are just slimmer and slimmer, and especially for publications that like newspapers and radio. So I feel really lucky. I get to cover Southern California science exclusively. And there's so much stuff that's just local. We just touched on one story there, P22, which is a great sort of, you know, human interest science story. But we've also got Caltech, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory from NASA. We've got USC, UCLA, lots of schools that churn out really interesting research. Some of the best neuroscience is being done in Southern California right now. We've got a lot of stem cell money in the state that has been used for some really interesting experiments. And I get to cover cool stuff like, you know, earthquake science and wildfires and weather and all these things that are, you know, the sort of the suite of disasters in California, like anything that The Rock has been in a movie about. I get to cover the science of what it's really like. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff here, and I really like that job. I also have a science podcast for kids, which is my passion project. It's called Brains On, and you can find it at brainson.org. And basically what we do here is we take really smart kids. We have them ask questions about the world, all the annoying stuff parents don't want to hear. You know, like, why is the sky blue? How do birds fly? What is this? You know, why is hair this color? How come French fries taste good? Anything they want. And then we get scientists to actually answer them. We have the kids interview the scientists, and it's really fun. Scientists are great at explaining things when an eight-year-old is asking it. And kids also ask these really amazingly profound questions that, you know, as adults, we've just stopped asking because they're hard. But, you know, it's really fun to hear the answers.
It's cool. It's almost like an adaptation of the Flame Challenge, which was, you know, Alan Alda's challenge. The first year it was called the Flame Challenge, saying basically, can you explain a flame? Can you explain fire to an eight-year-old? Which is it's a challenge for some scientists who are used to using the language of science, who are used to talking to peers and colleagues who understand basic principles that maybe an eight-year-old hasn't learned yet, and being able to scientifically talk about these topics. I think the next year they did something about, can you explain time, which is also it's deceptively complicated.
Right. We all know what these things are, but the minute you try to explain it, you know, without having to go into too much jargon or terminology, it gets really difficult.
Yeah, it's like, well, time is a thing that we tell. Like, and then you have to say, oh, no, but is it an actual thing? Is it something that we have imposed, trying to impose order on the universe? Is it intrinsic to the universe? And there's a lot of questions. And the funny thing is, you talk about these things that you figure just people know. Maybe a kid doesn't know, but some adult out there knows. And almost always, part of the answer is we still haven't figured that out, and we're still working to try and understand that core component of it.
Which is great. I love when you can tell a young budding scientist, we don't know the answer yet, because I think a lot of people, I've heard people say this, they felt like when they were growing up, they thought science was all written down, you know, in stone, in a book, and people have figured it out, and your job was to memorize it, you know, and sort of, you know, use it in your daily life. But it's not like that at all. Even fundamental questions about stuff, we're still figuring out the answers and going back and rewriting and telling a kid, we actually don't know the answer to that great question you just asked. Why don't you find out? You know, that's really good fodder for them to start thinking about it and at least considering that they have a role to play in moving this stuff forward, instead of thinking you can just learn about it and it's cool and that's it.
Yeah, that it's definitely flexible, that there's always a new place to go with it. And it's true that almost every single field or every single topic has some major unanswered fundamental questions that we haven't begun to fully be able to flesh out. And the great thing is there's someone out there. See, this is probably an interesting part of your job. There's someone out there who has expertise in that one weird thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, the more expert a scientist becomes, the more that they, you know, they finish their PhD and then they do their postdoc and then they have this lab where they're trying to answer one fundamental question, the more almost like bizarre the questions they answer are. It's like, oh, so you specifically study the poop that comes out of raccoons, you know?
Yeah.
Like, cool.
Or the fungus that grows on the poop that comes out of the raccoons. Yeah. I actually have a really great story about something like that for Brains On. So one of the questions that we got from kids a number of times before we decided we have to answer this was kind of, what are farts? And are they good for you? A lot of kids were curious, like, are farts good for you? Which is a question I never thought about. I think most of us just accept them. Uh-huh. But kids were sort of like, what are they doing for us? You know,
like, how funny. And also because, like, maybe if you're kind of sick, you get more farty. So maybe that means that you fart, like, farting is bad. Or, or is it good? Does it relieve something?
Right,
so funny.
I mean, it certainly smells bad.
Yeah.
So does that mean but we all do it. And, you know, it doesn't seem to be deathly for the most part. So we were, you know, looking into this, and we really thought, okay, if we're going to do this episode, we got to do it right, and we got to do all the different scientific elements of the fart. So not only did we explain kind of where they come from, which is kind of interesting, it's actually not you who's farting, it's bacteria in your gut who break down all your food, and then part of that, they release different gases, like, say, methane, And then that gas builds up in you and you're farting it out. But it's technically, you could blame it on the bacteria in your gut who are the ones who originally produced it. You know, sort of he who reduced it, produced it. Maybe.
I love that. Oh, so much better. Yeah.
And but one of the questions that I was really grappling with trying to find an expert in this specific thing was how the sound works, which I thought was just real simple. I'm like, oh, it's just your, you know, your butt cheeks kind of going.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Like it's just like the top of a balloon.
Right. But the thing is, I couldn't quite tell. OK, is it your butt cheeks flapping or is it the sphincter, the opening that kind of does the thing? And I was doing this great Google search where I'm like, what makes the sound of a fart? You know, butt cheeks or sphincter or, you know, and I was calling. And eventually you get to a point where, like, it seems on the internet, no one's giving you definitive answers and people are saying one thing and the other and you want to get to the bottom. So you start calling institutions that have great, you know, gastroenterologists or whatever. And you get on the line with their press person or a scientist. You say, I've got a really weird question, but I want to know, how do farts make their noise? And then you get asked them even more specifically. So how much of it is the cheeks and how much of it is the actual opening of the butt? And then can you explain it to me a little bit better about, like, you know, what makes a different kind of fart? How do silent ones happen? Like, what's going on there? And
amazing. So, what are the algorithms of the fart?
It was very complicated and surprisingly not very well studied. They said this was still something that for some reason scientists haven't picked up. But for the most part, people said it was not the cheeks. It was the opening of the butt itself, the sphincter. And it was like a balloon, like you said. And so we ended up likening it to a tuba player, the way that you can sort of the tightness of the mouth and how much air you push can really vary the tones and the sounds you get from a tuba. And your bum is kind of like that. It's sort of like it's sort of like a jazz player down there who's just sort of using different air levels and different, you know, tightness of the mouth to create all sorts of weird sounds. Think of it as like a free concert, you know, from your butt.
So your bum hole is like the mouth of the tuba player.
Yep.
So that just begs the question, why are there no butt trumpets? Like, why is there no attachment so that your farts can become music?
Probably because it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's true. You probably don't want a butt trumpet.
There was a guy, though, this is amazing. This blew my mind in my research I found, whose name was Le Petomane, which translated from French means the fartomaniac. And he was a well-regarded performer at the famous Moulin Rouge Cabaret, one of the most popular acts. And he had figured out how to fart on command, and he would do impressions. So he would do like, oh, here's a tenor singer, and the bass. And then, you know, he would like, you know, here's your mayor, and his wife, you know, that kind of stuff, all from his butt. And people found out that the way he managed to figure out how to do this was he was able to sort of suck in air and then expel it. So it didn't even smell. And high society was really into this. They thought this was a great gag. So he had this long career, all these imitators, and, you know, was just sort of this famous dude who'd managed to monetize what the rest of us, I think, you know, do for free.
That's amazing because, I mean, a fart really is like a burp down there, right?
Another burp.
It's just another type of burp. And I've known other people who know how to do that, can kind of swallow air.
Oh, yeah.
To burp, like a fake burp.
Yeah, so you can like do the Pledge of Allegiance or
exactly.
something.
Exactly. So you swallow a little bit of air, but I have no idea how to force air the wrong way up the bumhole.
Yeah, I wouldn't
like
even
a
begin.
Special skill. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Maybe somebody can publish a book about that.
His secrets went to the grave with him.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
This guy really should have, like, you know, put this all on paper.
That's why he's the only one.
Yeah.
Guys, you should totally tweet to me and Sandin if you can fart on command. We'll
right.
be very impressed.
You know, I might actually want a sound clip.
Yes.
Do some impressions.
Because that's one thing that you do in your work that I have not yet mastered here on the podcast. The podcast format for me has always been, and I made this decision at the beginning because it was really Rogan first kind of inspired me to start the podcast because I was a guest on his and he was like, you should do this. And I had, you know, listened to Star Talk and I had been on Star Talk a few times and I was like, I love this idea. Even though Star Talk has a little more formatting than Rogan, of just a very loose conversational, like, let's shoot the shit. And it's kind of eavesdropping in on somebody. You know, they're very different structures of podcasts. Some are very formulaic and some are much looser, like WTF with Mark Maron or Joe Rogan or even Nerdist with Hardwick.
Right.
And so I wanted to go that route. Let's talk to cool, interesting, really smart people, but let's just talk to them the way people talk. You do very traditional radio interviews, which I'm always so impressed with because they're so produced and you can tell a really interesting story in a in a short amount of time because you're very selective with the mm-hmm. the parts of the story that you tell. But one aspect that you use so masterfully is sound. And I still, to this day, I always say, I'm going to start doing these little, I want to do these little vignettes where I go out and source sounds and I tell stories around these sounds. You've really mastered that. And I have to ask, is that the most fun part of telling a story? Is the interview the most fun part? Is sitting in the edit bay? What do you like the most about telling a really well-rounded story for the ears and not for the eyes?
That's a really good question. And thanks for bringing it up, because it's going to make me think here. about my job and how much I enjoy it. I'd say the interviews can be stressful and hard, because when you're in the field, you're trying to balance so many things of both, do I get all the answers I need? Are they being said in a clear way? Are my batteries about to run out? Is there wind noise on my microphone? Am I getting all the sounds? How much time do I have until this person has to leave me? So that part can be very stressful. It can be fun occasionally because you go out and do stuff, you know, like you interview a researcher on a boat and she tells you about the dolphins she's been studying for years and points out some that she can recognize or something. And you're just like, that's so cool.
Oh, I always assumed you would just do your interviews always in a nice, quiet office.
No, you want the dirt and grit of the real world sound as much as possible. And you always ask somebody, hey, can I come out with you and do something? So I'm interviewing a researcher probably next week about El Nino, and she's been studying how the estuaries have been trying to absorb a lot of the rain that we've been getting. And I want to go, I could interview her in her office, but I want to be out there on the estuary with her, tromping through the wetlands, get the sound of the muck and the, you know, the water and all that, because it'll take the listener there.
Yeah.
So that part can be, it's like equal parts fun and stress. But my favorite is when you have all the pieces collected and you're mixing them and you're trying to sort of create this story. And a lot of it is just condensing. So if you go out with somebody and you do this, you find all these little moments of sound, it's sort of like taking pictures with your phone. You know, your iPhone is not that great at getting the scene, like a panorama. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you usually get up really close to your favorite things and capture those so people notice them. It's the same with sound. Your microphone really doesn't paint this great portrait of the whole scene unless you have a certain kind of microphone. But what you can do is get really close to the various things that are making noise, whether it's, you know, the ripples of the water off the side of the boat, or whether it's the sonar they're using to track something, or it's the little radio that they're, you know, calling back to the shore with or something. All those little pieces you collect throughout the day. And then when you go put them together in the studio, that's what's fun, because you're sort of piecing together all these little pieces that you heard and in like maybe just 30 seconds instead of 3 hours. And it really puts people somewhere there. It transports them. That's so fun. And you kind of do it. And at first you're like, oh, it's just all this random crap I have, and you're like, this is never gonna make a story. But then you start to put it together and you're transported yourself back when you hit play and hear what you just did, and it's just magical. You're kind of like, I don't know, you're just gone, and you're like, wow, I did that. I like took people somewhere.
Yeah, that's so cool. That's similar, I think, to the way that when I'm working on my local show on KCET, the post-production process, of course, I have to work with a video editor, because I have no fucking idea how to do that myself. I sit next to him while he does it, and we work together and we talk about the different decisions that we're making. And it is a little overwhelming. You're like, okay, I have 6 interviews. I think I have enough B-roll, which is probably very similar. B-roll, which is like the video portion of these little sound effects.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's like to cover the interviews with, what am I looking at while I'm listening? And then so much of it, it's so true, so much of a story comes together in the edit. I'm assuming it's the same for a beautiful audio story as it is for a beautiful video story, because you can pretty much turn, you can polish a turd, or you can, you know, scratch up a diamond in the, I don't know, I just made that up, but I think it makes sense. In the edit bay, you really can.
And yeah.
I talk to people from the reality world, right? Because what working sort of in SciComm, you're dancing a little bit with reality.
Oh, yeah.
A lot.
You mean reality TV.
Yeah, with reality TV. And sometimes they even consider science.
I feel like
television.
I'm dancing with reality all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes I'm stepping on reality's
little
foot.
Yeah, sometimes. But yeah, sometimes I'm in the far reaches. But yeah, it's definitely, I talk to people who work in reality who do these edits, and they're like, oh yeah. You know, people be like, oh my gosh, that girl seems so dumb. You edited her to seem so dumb. And then it'll be like, oh no, I edited her to be as smart as she possibly could in that clip. There's a lot that you have to do, these decisions you have to make. Yet, we're not talking about pure entertainment. We're talking about journalism. So
right.
There's also this whole layer of journalistic integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you have to focus on, right? When you're telling these stories, you're like, am I putting myself in this, or am I telling the story as objectively as I possibly can?
Yeah, I'm endlessly fascinated by reality TV, and I'd love to do a job switch because I want to see what they do. The people I've talked to who do it, I do think there's an element of similar skill sets to journalism. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the end result is totally different, but you're still like, you know, as a journalist, you're often, you've got a story that you're telling, you know, and there's different characters you're trying to get, and you're trying to sort of use what they're saying to sort of, you know, move the story forward. You know, you don't use everything they say. You use the parts that sort of advance the story to get to the next point you want to make, especially with, you know, something like radio where you kind of have a limited amount of time. You're trying to say, okay, if this person covers one point, I don't want the next person to say the same thing because we only have so much time.
But if you want something to be like punctuated and that person didn't say it that well, do you use their clip? Do you do it in your own VO?
Exactly.
Do you find a different person to
say
it?
Yeah, all that stuff I think is it's a challenge that I really find rewarding to solve it as a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
But then with reality TV, the rules are just off, right? It's like you can tell them to re-say something exactly how you want, or you just reshoot something like, hey, can you take that cry again real quick?
Yeah,
like,
it's true. And different shows do it at various levels. Like I have definitely heard from shows that try their best to stay as true to life as they can and do it much more verite, much more documentary style. And then you've got the in-betweens where they don't actually invent stuff, but they'll kind of plant a seed. They'll be like, the producers will legit talk to the characters and be like, I don't know. I mean, I heard Sally was saying some shit about your boyfriend. And they'll be like, no, she did not.
Sally.
You know, and then it's like crazy. And then you have shows where they full on just plant stuff. Like, I'm about to bust everybody's bubble right now. I have it on good authority that
ooh, here it comes.
Literally almost everything in Storage Wars was planted in those stupid storage units. I know, it's such a bummer.
All that money I invested in storage units.
I know.
No wonder I only got old moldy clothes.
I know. It's like, that's the odds, I think.
Yeah,
we're working with the numbers there. But also, I have it on good authority. This one was the real bummer for me, that all the people...
Don't say Pawn Stars.
Oh, no. I don't know anything about Pawn Stars.
Thank you.
But I watch a lot of HGTV. You know, everybody has a channel that's kind of the background noise channel. For
yeah.
a lot of people, it's cooking.
Your wallpaper channel.
Yeah, the wallpaper channel. For me, it's a home and garden.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because we just bought a house. We've been renovating. We've been doing a lot of work. So House Hunters, it's like constantly on.
Mm.
All those people already live in those houses. I
know. Oh, no.
So they straight up shop for their own house and then two other fake houses you know they're never going to buy.
Oh,
and they literally move
man.
All their shit out of the house and then put it back in at the end.
That's because, you know... That's like shows a slice of hope for those of us who are like trying to find a home. It's because it's so stressful. And you think like, well, on TV, they make it seem easy. I mean, I knew it was fake, but that's really
it's
fake.
It's really, I know. And I've got to hope that I did use the word all those people. And maybe that's not true. Maybe it's just that the episodes that the producers that I know and have spoken to, that those specifically were kind of fudged.
Yeah.
Maybe some of them are true house hunts, but... There is definitely a practice within that show.
Well, you know, this is the other thing I think about in terms of these reality TV shows versus what I do with journalism. I mean, aside from, you know, the whole we would never tell somebody move out of their house and pretend to move back in.
Yeah, exactly.
They have a production schedule that they're trying to meet, and they're trying to repeat the same story over and over and over again. Whereas, like, you know, the kind of stuff that you and I get to do more as journalists when we're doing that stuff is that we get to follow the story where it leads us. So if you're talking to somebody and it turns out your original idea about – you know, their hunt for a home or their research is not what you thought, well, you still have your story. You don't have to scrap it and say, it's not what I promised. You know, you talk to your editor and you rework it and you make it work around what the facts are and what the person's really telling you. And that can often lead you to places you never even expected. You start with one story and you end up with something totally different. And
it's
that can be really fun and exciting for you. You're sort of uncovering something.
Yeah. And there's also not, I think there's not as much of an expectation of high level conflict drama.
Yeah.
Like you do want drama.
It's great if you can get it.
Yeah. It's great if you get drama naturally. But if the drama is just not there, let's say you're really excited about an interview and you feel like the content of the interview is going to be so powerful because this story is one you've been wanting to tell. And then you go and you interview the expert and it's flat. They're not giving you what you were hoping for.
Right.
Maybe they're a little bit like there's not as much emotion in their voice, or they're hedging themselves so much that they won't actually ever give you a true opinion about something.
Yes.
Which is very common with the science
I get
community.
It. I get it, but I hate it.
It's frustrating. And there is always this thought in your mind that you're fighting. It's like, if only... You know, and it's usually really dark and morbid. Like, if only they had, you know, overcome some horrible disease. Like, if only they, and you're like, okay, Okay, that's so fucked up of me to think. But the truth of the matter is, you have what you have. And so you figure out, well, is that actually the thread? Or do I find a new backbone of the story and this is now detail for something else? Like you said, you follow the paths that it gives you. I remember doing a story last season for KCET about homelessness. Somebody in the office was knew somebody who worked in Santa Clarita in this shopping strip. And there's a riverbed, a dry riverbed behind the shopping strip. And they were saying, you know, the homeless people live down in the river. And then they come up to this really posh shopping strip and they're urinating on the concrete and they're leaving needles everywhere. And it's a real problem. And the city's not doing enough about it. Mm-hmm. And we're like, okay, that's interesting. So we go out there and we start interviewing the shop owners. We're like, okay, so what's the problem? And they're like, I mean, there's some homeless people, but you know, I'll give them some food if I need to, but they stay out of the way. And we're looking around and it's like pristine concrete and it's like really beautiful. And we're like, I don't know about this. Like nobody's really telling us that the problem is what it is. So we go down into the riverbed and we start talking to some of these people who live down there. And their stories are so fascinating that ultimately we meet this guy, Mike. Mike used to work at Lockheed. You know, had a family. He had kids. He started doing drugs when he lost his job. He lost everything. And now he lives in a tent in the river. You would think he was a cop. He's well-dressed. He has a buzz cut. He speaks so eloquently. And you're like, your story is beautiful and difficult and fascinating. And he was such an amazing character that Mike became the core of the story, Mike's struggle, and it became the new face of homelessness, this idea that there are people who are, you know, we're all one bad decision or one difficult kind of break away from living the same way. These are our peers.
Right.
And we have to remember that. And I do love it when you do have the opportunity. You think you have a story, maybe it doesn't work out, you find a new story and you can do that. But you're right, with reality TV, it's like, this is the story that we pitched at the beginning of the season.
And we are going to get it
exactly
by tooth or claw.
Regardless.
You know, in that way, the way you just described that, it is a lot like science in general, you know, because people come up with one theory and they're like, I'm out to test that theory, and they write it down and they tell all their peers and they get their grant money. But sometimes it just that's not the truth. That's not what science is telling you. And so you have to change and say, OK, well, instead, it looks like this is what happens. And I didn't quite understand that. But people don't say that's a failure. They say, great. Well, now we know that your theory before is not the right theory. That's great progress.
Yeah, it's literally the difference between science and pseudoscience, right? Which is full of logical fallacies, moving the goalposts. You don't get the answer that you want, so you restate the question. There's all these things you do in pseudoscience to try and keep promoting the idea that that supplement is legitimate, or that, you know, that aspect of alternative medicine is legitimate. You just ask a different question. Maybe I can answer that. Oh, maybe this didn't pan out to support my hypothesis, so I'll move the goalpost.
Right. I'll say the research was flawed, or you weren't testing the right thing. And
exactly. And that's kind of the same thing. You're right. Between journalism and reality TV, it's almost like it's not less than. I don't want to put it in, because pseudoscience is legit less than science. Like, it's something we need to be careful about because we can all be suckered into it. And it's bad for the consumer.
Right.
But when it comes to reality TV, there's no kind of understanding. There's no social contract that this is real.
Right. And I think most people are smart enough now that if you sign up for it, you know what you're getting. Yeah. And if you're watching it, you know what you're watching.
Exactly.
Hopefully.
But it is, when it becomes misleading, that's when it's difficult. When you see things on maybe educational channels, like, you know, the bummer that happened when TLC, when the Learning Channel really became TLC, or when we even on some of the bastions, I've worked on these networks, National Geographic, which I think still actually has a lot of good staying power, especially Nat Geo Wild. Mm-hmm. And I think you see the same thing with Discovery. You know, Science Channel is really still a good bastion. But Discovery, they have really realized people watch reality. And that's what we want to market to our viewers. And it makes you a little bit sad because you're like, why is there a show about Bigfoot on like a science channel?
Right.
Like, that's fundamentally not science.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's something that I think that I've struggled with as somebody who works in media. I'm wondering your take on it. Just the media landscape of today, you know, especially here in America. Because often I find myself going, if only I lived in Canada, you know, or if only I lived in England, where I think that there are more outlets available for either hard-hitting journalism or a little bit more kind of intellectual television. But you work in that. It's almost like, I don't know. I don't want to say it's a joke, because it's not a joke, but this idea that like NPR is one of the last places where you can find legitimate journalism.
Yeah, well, it depends who you ask. There are certain people on the right wing who would swear that we're very liberal and biased,
which is hilarious.
I think we try really hard not to be liberal either way, and I think a lot of places don't try at all, which says something to me. But that is why I like public radio. I like that they're still focused on journalism, and it does motivate you a little bit more. Journalism is never going to make you rich, especially public radio, unless you consider tote bags a valid form of currency.
I haven't gotten a KCET tote bag.
Oh, you're
tell that to my public TV station.
Yeah, dude, it changes your life when you have so many tote bags. you're like putting totes in totes, and you show up at the grocery store like, do you want a bag? And you're like, honey.
KPCC got me covered.
Excuse me, dude, but let me just tote. You're like, it's a clown car. You're just pulling more totes out of your tote bag.
And I do love that, like, there is a little bit of a, I don't want to say hipster because I feel like that's a little derogatory, but there's like a
coolness.
It got
cool.
It got cool.
I don't remember when, but it got cool at some
point. They
sell
NPR t-shirts at like Urban Outfitters.
Justin Timberlake was wearing one in a picture once. Yeah, I've been in radio for about 10 years, but somewhere in the last five or so, people have been like a lot more willing to talk to me at parties.
It's so funny. And it's true. It's like NPR and PBS. I think that as you get older and you start to see kind of these bastions crumbling around you and you're like, thank God for Frontline. You know what I mean? Or like, thank God for Science Friday or all these different things that you can rely on.
Well, I've wanted to ask you about this because I feel like science has been going through something similar too. You know, like I grew up in a really science-minded household. My mom is an ER doctor. She's, incredibly scientific literate, and she loves to explain things in form of, theorems and scientific principles and stuff, which is great. As a kid, I was growing up and I thought this stuff was so cool. Like when I was getting picked on in school, my mom would talk about alpha male theories and, our talk about sex was much more about like sperms and, how it all worked and different birth control options and their efficacy ratings and stuff.
There are no birds and bees in that conversation.
No birds. Unless she was going to talk about like, pollen and avian reproductive methods or something. But the cool thing about, growing up like that, I always loved science, but I also knew it wasn't cool. Like, there wasn't like a lot of people I knew who also liked to think the world was that way. But then it suddenly started changing like within the last 10 years and people were really, even who like were, art majors or people who loved theater or literature or business, suddenly there was like this cachet around knowing about science and people were sharing a lot of science studies on Facebook. And I was reading that in some surveys that the thing people wish there was more news about was science and scientific discoveries. And I kind of wondered, why do you think that happened? Why is our generation, sort of millennials and maybe young Gen Xers really into this in a way that I don't think past generations were?
Yeah, I think that's interesting because, I'm sure if we go back far enough during more like scientific revolutions, we could find times when it was like really kind of avant-garde to be into the sciences.
Yeah,
like sometimes, when I read these historical nonfiction books about different explorers and, about different scientists, and you're like, oh, only in the finest circles.
Like,
who am I reading about right now? Humboldt. I'm reading about, I think that's his name, Humboldt, and he traveled the world, and he's like the kind of the explorer that so many things are named after.
Is it Humboldt County?
That you don't know him. It's probably everything named Humboldt is named after this guy. Is it William Humboldt? Let me look up the book. I love this. I love making my listeners like listen to me while I'm like going through Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. And that was written by, that's not the person who wrote it. Andrea Wolf. Yes. It's a beautiful book. I'm slowly getting through it. I do find that books written by historians are a little harder for me to read because they've got a lot of information.
They love to be thorough.
Exactly. They're very thorough. But Humboldt would like travel to South America and then he would go back to Europe and then he'd be hanging out with like Goethe and he'd be hanging out with like all of these famous painters and just these Enlightenment thinkers,
Right.
And it was very cool back then. And then you're right. We went through a period, especially during the kind of Reagan years, where I think that science was not really put in the forefront. And we're starting to see, especially with this millennial generation, a cool factor. Like when I say nerd and I'm like, talk nerdy, baby. Like it's, I love being a nerd. I'll get emails from people and they're very different. You'll get emails from people that are close to my age who are like, I love the reinvention of the nerd. Oh, I'm so proud to be a nerd. And then you'll get emails from science teachers who are much older who say like, do you have to use the word nerd? I still worry that it's very derogatory.
I've gotten that too. And I try not to think about that and hedge that when I use it, say I'm on live radio and I'm like geeking out or something. I say the word geek out or like I go, this guy is a total, you know, this guy is a spider nerd. He loves all these spiders. And then I wonder if someone's going to think, am I saying that like in a mean way? But I totally mean it in a positive way. Like this guy is nerded out on spiders and he's going to come on our show and talk about this. Or like, you know, this lady is totally into, you know, mollusks. She's a mollusk nerd. And that's like a cool thing in my view. But I've definitely had older folks say, you know, I wish you would not use that word.
It's interesting. And so it makes me wonder, is it because of the internet? Is it because of global connection? Is it because all of the nerds who were proud to be nerds but could only maybe find one or two close friends in their school have been able to find way bigger social circles and then those bleed out because they're like these nucleation points? Or is it because we as a generation, I think, have to be more environmentally conscientious? And with the forced conscientiousness comes a sort of appreciation of the environment and of nature that we didn't really see before. You know, I definitely liken it unto, I think I've used this example before on the podcast. Have you seen the remake of 21 Jump Street?
I saw the sequel.
Okay, you saw
the
sequel.
Not the first one, but it was hysterical.
So yeah, it's really funny. So in the original, you know, you've got Channing Tatum and you've got,
Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill. And, spoiler alert, but they like mix up their student profiles so they have to pretend to be the opposite of who they are.
So good.
It's so good.
I gotta go see that one.
And so I think it's Channing Tatum that shows up to school in this like hot rod and he like parks in the handicap space and there's all this like smoke coming out of the exhaust and he thinks that all the kids are gonna think he's so cool. He like gets out of the car and he puts on his backpack. Yeah. And then these kids are like, ugh, where's your Prius? Like they're so pissed, right? That his car is like bad for the environment. And I think that really has been a shift that like young kids want to drive electric and they want these cool gadgets that are like low energy consumption.
Oh man, I bet you there's so much interesting stuff to look under this. I was just hearing a story on NPR actually about how millennials and their car choices are not about flashy, exciting cars anymore. They want really practical and environmentally friendly cars. And it's been a challenge for these car makers to think, how do you sell non-flashy? We're so used to like trying to outdo each other in luxury cars and this and that, but it's really the sort of more practical, is it eco-friendly? Can it Bluetooth really well? Is it, you know, a functional car? But, you know, I also think some other factors that might have led to this were, you know, I think that a lot of us grew up with great science communicators like Bill Nye.
Mm-hmm,
and you see
true.
Someone like him now be having a renaissance in his life. There was a period where he sort of faded away from consciousness and then he became popular again and now can sell out auditoriums to people like, you know, my age and your age who remember that. And then I also think, you know, the sort of the nerd factor of things like, you know, all of Joss Whedon's Mafia and Comic-Con and all this stuff, it just sort of like, it really has, pop culture has found a way to like make nerd cool. And with that, science became part of that. And then there's the whole thing about, you know, a lot of millennials lack a sort of concrete religion.
Yeah,
I wouldn't
say
that they're all atheists, but a lot of Pew surveys have shown that like a sort of non-identified religion is kind of growing in younger people. And I think because of that, to have a common ground, a lot of people are turning to science. And I wouldn't say that it's equivalent to a religion, but I think that it is sort of a unifying principle a lot of people like to share with each other as a way to like understand the world.
And there are high levels of correlation between scientific thought and lack of, I would say, not necessarily a lack of organized religion, but a lack of like
Concrete doctrine,
maybe? Like literate organized religion. You know what I mean? Like a lack of people who believe in a literary translation of the Bible, and you do see that a lot of, especially physical scientists, it's less so on more the life sciences side, but definitely on the physical sciences side, you see more atheist. That science and atheism in a lot of ways is highly, highly correlated.
Right.
Like there's not that many theoretical physicists that are religious. There might be some that are deists. You know what I mean? But there's not that many that are going to say that they're Christian. It's very rare.
So I want to ask you then, because, you know, I know that you're like me, you're someone who's heavily delved into the sciences and you have a science background.
Mm-hmm.
Are there things that you choose to believe in or do, even though you know scientifically that there's no evidence to do it?
For me, no. That's a really tough thing for me. And I think it's partially a fundamental personality trait, but I think it's also something that's been curated in my life over the relationships that I've made. So I tried to believe in God when I was young and I couldn't. So I left the Mormon church at 14. I tried to believe in Santa Claus and I couldn't. I have no memory of ever having a belief in any of these like kind of fairy tales that your parents tell to make you behave.
What about
like
small
that?
Things like, you know, I don't know, not stepping on a crack is a really obvious
example.
Okay. Or like
superstitions.
Yeah, or like saying a little prayer before you, you know, try to, you know, do some really cool maneuver off a diving board or.
So I definitely had a period in my life where I did do that more, like where I had superstitions more. But I think as I found myself identifying, there was a shift more like in my late 20s, early 30s, honestly, where I always identified as an atheist from the time I was like 14. I was like, I'm a hardcore atheist and I don't believe in blah, blah, blah.
And got then the patch, I found, got the sticker.
Totally. Yeah.
In the fan club.
Yeah, actually, I might get a tattoo, like a Scarlet A. I'm thinking about it. But then I found the skeptic movement. And now being a bigger part of the skeptic movement, I think it's a conscientiousness that you try to hold on to every day. So although we all have those little things, I think that I and others in the skeptic movement actually try to actively find our own cognitive biases and become aware of our own superstitions so that we can at least attempt to either break them or control them and think in the most scientifically minded way possible. That does not mean that we are successful by any stretch,
right,
but at least we try. And I read, you know, skeptic magazines. I pointed here to a stack, but it's like Emmy magazine is on top. There's a Nat Geo. I have a bunch of skeptic magazines.
I believe you.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I'm the fifth member of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and being around Steve and Jay and Bob and Evan, I think has been really helpful
too.
Some
of the pro skeptics out there.
Pro skeptics. And so I think the more that you find yourself identifying as a skeptic, the more that you at least attempt to not let those little things occur, although we all have them.
But some of them are fun too. Like, so for instance, you know, I do like, and this is kind of a confession I'll make right now, I like buying those little sage bundles and lighting them to smudge a place, you know? And I know it's like the thought is you're spreading good vibes or clearing out bad juju or whatever. And, you know, there's no logical reason that I'd think any of that would happen. Like, really what I'm doing is putting, like, burnt sage in my house.
Yeah, you're making it smell like burnt sage, which
but
is nice.
I like it. I don't know. I get a comforting feeling out of that. And then there are other things. Like, you know, I've talked to researchers who kind of think that taking, like, you know, these like, drinks full of, you know, probiotics, like, really don't do much. You're getting way too much, and they don't really lodge in your system long enough for you to, like, say you're getting a huge burst of, like, probiotics. There's no, at least that I've seen, conclusive research saying that it's great for you. But I still like getting a drink of probiotics or taking a probiotic pill, even if I'm not 100% sure that it's doing much for me.
Yeah, and when I think about things that the scientific evidence is sort of inconclusive about, that's where things get fuzzy. And it's interesting because, yes, there are obviously personal preferences, and there's also individualistic biology. So, for example, I don't want to say who in my life, because maybe this person doesn't want this to be public, but somebody in my life has some issues with their gut, and they have their entire lives. And it turns out that their diagnosis is something called SIBO, which is small intestine bacterial overgrowth, which tends to contribute to IBS or Crohn's-like symptoms, but they consistently don't test positive for IBS or Crohn's. So the idea here is, their gut motility is not as high as it needs to be. Their peristaltic movement doesn't go fast enough, so they get a buildup of bacteria in their small intestine. And there are actually probiotics, for example, that are FDA-approved medical foods that only doctors can prescribe, that individuals can take, that are meant to encourage the right kind of bacterial growth and sort of kill off bacteria that can be detrimental to your intestinal lining. Same thing with fish oil. Like, I recently watched the Frontline episode about supplements. And I was like, yes, they're finally doing an expose on supplements. It's all bullshit. It's expensive pee. But there are some that where it's a wavy line. There is such a thing as prescription fish oil that is regulated by the FDA, where studies actually show that it has a protective effect for individuals who have a nutritional deficit and require it. There's also over-the-counter fish oil, which tends to not be regulated the same way, so there's no telling whether or not it's pure, whether or not it has the effect that it has.
Right.
So there, you know, some things are wiggly like that. I think probiotics are one of them.
I agree. I'm not saying I'm discounting them altogether.
Yeah, it's like there's an up and down. So maybe you have individual microbiome or biology that actually does respond well, and that's why when you take a probiotic, you're like, I actually fucking feel better.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a total placebo.
Maybe it's a which is not to be discounted.
Yeah, there's which still works. works, right?
Yeah. You know, I've been reading actually about this, and I find this really fascinating. The placebo effect is on the rise mm-hmm. throughout science. And this is a huge problem, because if you're trying to test a drug, you need to be able to show that it's really effective. But if everybody's getting, you know, a positive result, even if they didn't take the drug, your drug might have been effective, but so might have been thinking you took the drug. And so scientists are trying to find groups of people who are sort of immune to the placebo effect. And there's actually a great researcher at UCLA who's sort of made this his calling, and he's been doing all sorts of research on this. And if I remember correctly, one of the groups are people who suffer from depression are less prone to the placebo effect.
I wonder if skeptics are also less prone.
I wonder. We should maybe get a cohort together and start using, you know, seeing if they want to volunteer for studies just to see, because that could be, you know, as the skeptics grow, they could be a really important part of the scientific research, you know, testing out drugs and
stuff. Yeah, because it's almost like this intrinsic mindfulness to not allow the placebo effect to work.
You have to actively fight it.
And it's like the same thing where some people can be hypnotized and some can't, right? Because it's a lot of it's a lot of just allowing yourself to kind of get into that zone. And for me, I've never been able to, because I'm that person who's always like, this is bullshit.
Yeah, right off the get-go. You're born, you're like, as soon as it starts, you're ready to like shoot it down.
Yeah.
But yeah, so one of the reasons they think that maybe that the placebo effect is growing is, you know, we've all been sort of hypnotized by TV. America has that law where we're allowed to show commercials for drugs, and people are becoming more and more accustomed to the idea that a pill could fix anything, you know, that there's, you know, you can get a pill and it'll give you side effects. You can take another pill and that'll cure those side effects. And then you'll take another pill to help amplify the first pill. And I mean, it's getting to the, you know, pretty crazy proportions, but I would love to see if maybe people in other countries who haven't been exposed to that same direct advertising of medicines, if the placebo effect is more minimal or more what it used to be there. But it's an interesting problem, and it's kind of amazing how much our minds can unlock actions in our body.
So true, which is why even as a skeptic, I think that mindfulness meditation is a fascinating area of inquiry, because there's a lot of good science backing up the fact that certain people, when they utilize these mindfulness techniques, can actually affect their physiology.
Oh, yeah.
Which is crazy.
And you can watch as certain people meditate and you see the brainwaves sort of change.
Yeah, and you can actually measure things like body temperature changing, and especially people who are really trained, these like monks who live in these regions. I'm always fascinated by this crossover between what I think of as the legitimate side of religion and spirituality, mm-hmm. the side that really is about philosophy and about
self-improvement.
Yeah, and understanding your body and your thoughts and your minds more. I mean, it's something I've always been desperately afraid of. It's something I've never been good at. It's something my shrink is always trying to like reiterate that I should try. But it is really interesting where the lines are concrete and where the lines are blurrier. And I think it's important as a skeptic to know the difference mm-hmm. and not to just assume that everything's really black and white.
That makes me feel good that you say that. Yeah. You know, that makes, because like I like that. I like there's room in between. And mm-hmm. I love having mystery left in the world. And I love sometimes, like I said, I love doing little things sometimes that I know might not amount to much, but that make me feel good that there is some sort of surprise or things that I can't quite comprehend that are still in the world. Even if like, if I had to write it down on paper, I would say my beliefs are much more black and white.
Yeah.
But I'm excited to see what science will take us and what sort of things that we thought were sort of mystical or, you know, just sort of part of a religion that turn out to actually have some sort of scientific part to it, even if it is sort of a placebo or community-based thing, or, you know, people learning to meditate and do things, you know, self-regulating their body, sort of self-monitoring and stuff like that. All that is fascinating, and I can't wait to learn more.
Yeah, I think as individuals, this idea of ritual and tradition actually might have positive physiological benefits, but also we often study things as skeptics in only that context. Does it have a positive benefit from a physiological standpoint? Well, maybe it has a psychological benefit.
Yeah, or cultural. You know, a lot of our culture has been preserved thanks mm-hmm. to these institutions and these rituals. And you know, long before we had written words, that's how a lot of it survived, was through mm-hmm. telling and through stories and all that stuff. And thankfully, you know, we did that because that's kind of how we built our societies and cultures, was having collective knowledge. Before we had the internet and the cloud to store it all in, you just had stories, you know,
you had to hand them down.
Myths and these beliefs, and you had to pass them down. And
they're the same culture to culture, which is also fascinating. You can find these common threads where they've been repackaged and passed down even more. I definitely think it's interesting. You're right. I have rituals. Everybody has rituals.
Right.
I don't think anybody lives perfectly randomly. Like, I think about when I take a shower, I do everything step by step the exact same way every time.
Because you got to do it on autopilot at like yeah, 6 a.m. before a shoot, I'm sure.
If I couldn't do it that same way, like I would never wash my face before I wash my hair. Because the idea of like the conditioner running down my face, undoing my face wash blows my mind. Like there's certain, you have to shave your legs while the conditioner's on your hair, like soaking in more. Like there's all these weird things where you have to do it in a certain order. Or like my closet is organized in a very particular way. Or even weird little things like I don't eat Lucky Charms often. But when I eat Lucky Charms, I eat all the little crunchy bits first and I save all the marshmallows for the end.
Well, that just makes sense because they're dessert.
That's true.
That's but your breakfast dessert.
We all have those little things like everything in your kitchen has to go in just the right places and your desk has to be organized just so. And it gives you a sense of like order and purpose and calmness and zen. I mean, there has to be some sort of psychological benefit to feeling ordered in your life and to not living in chaos.
Yeah.
But yeah, but then you take it too far into like a feng shui kind of place.
Or like OCD. Where
exactly.
It's and like, so, oh, the forks must line up.
And yeah, it's like all of these things yeah. I think are existing on a continuum.
Spectrum, yeah.
A spectrum.
Randomness and messiness too have a great role in a lot of people's lives. I've, you know, studies that creative people have messy rooms and stuff
true,
like that.
True, yeah.
I'm not sure if that's a real study, but I'm sure someone's looked at it.
There are, you know, for me, it's about kind of like a sine wave. It's like I like to let things go and then tidy them back up and yeah. let things go and tidy them back up, which I think is the only way to really live your life.
Yeah.
It's difficult to do it otherwise.
Ride that sine wave.
Yeah. All right. Well, Sandin, I know that you have a hard out coming up because you're such a busy guy and you're so important.
Yeah.
But before we go, I have to close with the same two questions that I ask everybody when they come on the podcast. It seems to be a lot of people's favorite part.
Yeah.
So
hit me.
So I'll hit you. They're big ones. The big pictures. All right. So to start, when you think about the future in whatever context matters to you, whether it's personal or global or whatever, first, what is the thing that, you know, you're most concerned about, that bothers you the most, that keeps you up the most at night, you know, that brings you worry? But on the flip side of that, the second question is, what are you most hopeful for and excited about and kind of optimistic in the future?
So the first one, by far the thing I'm worried most about is people's sort of tendency to fight each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't just mean physically because that's really terrible, but it's also been on the decline in society for a while compared to the way we used to be. And that's great. And I think that we'll probably continue that trend. But you even see it in our own elections. We love an us versus them narrative. Like you said earlier, conflict is something we're drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to get over that. Because there's always, for as many good ideas as there are and people trying to do things that might help the world, there's going to be somebody who's going to find a way to disagree or have a conflict about it. And politics is basically, you know, the business of conflict. You know, you can only get elected if you shoot someone else down or you disagree with them. If someone takes one stance, you automatically have to take the other to have, like, you know, so there's two different choices, at least in America.
Yeah.
And I think that's a huge problem. And I really... You know, and sometimes I kind of secretly think like, man, if aliens invaded, it would be great because then we could have another them and we could like get our act together here on Earth, you know. So
we see that. We see common enemy. We see banding together. It's like after 9/11, you have a common enemy. But then that all that does is just broaden out the us versus them narrative.
Yeah. That's why aliens come, you know, like Independence Day scenario.
Yeah.
Then they go away for a long time. And then when they come back, Earth is highly organized, peaceful. We've solved all our climate problems and we welcome them and we find a way to broker a deal where they leave us alone. That's my scenario.
I like it. You should make a movie about that.
Yeah. What gives me hope? I'll say, you know, I'm sort of excited about the singularity.
Nice.
Like, I do sometimes think that, like, that, like, moment in Her when all the robots start talking to each other could happen and, like, they'll help solve a lot of our problems. But, you know, I also have a lot of faith in the kids today. You know, I do this podcast, Brains On. We work with a ton of smart kids. And, you know, I meet so many impressive parents who are really trying to get their kids to think about the world and challenge them with big questions. And I know it's trite to say, but, you know, I'm excited to see what happens when a lot of the kids who are growing up today in the culture we're talking about that love science, that's so actively involved in, you know, thinking about the environment, what they're going to do when they get the reins of power. Hopefully the process of adulthood will be gentle on them and it won't turn them into the kind of adults that we see today that bicker and fight and squabble. That's kind of my dream.
Yeah, I like your dream. I think it's a good, hopeful dream. And it's so true. Like, never in the history of the planet have we had a generation that's more equipped to solve really big and really complicated problems.
And work together on it,
too. And work together because they're globally connected. They have tools that we couldn't even dream of in the past. And they're natives on these platforms. Kids grow up speaking or being able to communicate in code.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We couldn't do that.
That's right. And that does kind of preserve their world from adults messing with it too much or, you know, sort of making them feel bad about the way they think or do things. And that's great. I have a lot of confidence in that, you know?
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, Sandon, I've had so much fun with you being on the show. Before you go, please let everybody know where they can find Brains On, where they can find maybe some of the, I'm assuming, can people listen to certain web clips?
All my stories are online.
Oh, good, good, good.
Just search Sandon Totten, S-A-N-D-E-N-T-O-T-T-E-N. And KPCC and all my stories will come up. I did one recently about El Nino that I think is really fun. But yeah, you can also find me on Twitter at Sandon Totten, and Brains On is brainson.org or at brains_on, both in Twitter and Instagram.
And how do you solicit questions for Brains On? Is it something where parents of kids who have interesting questions can reach out to
you? Oh, yeah. Just email brainson at M, as in Minnesota Public Radio, because we're a collaboration. Brainson at mpr.org. We've gotten hundreds and hundreds of questions, but we love getting more. And kids can send them in. Parents can send them in. Dogs or cats, if they're literate and can type, can send them in. Anybody can send them in. So welcome them all.
Awesome. Well, Sandon, I had such a good time talking to you. I'm going to have you back on, too, because we didn't even like scratch the surface of our mutual love for punk rock music.
Oh my gosh.
Which I'm really sad about.
Yeah, I really want to talk about like punk rock and science one day. Let's do that.
I know. So that'll have to be in round two. But in the meantime, thank you for joining me.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
So much fun. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.